History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Maintaining a standing army is really hard and really expensive. That's why throughout human history, with only a few exceptions like the Roman Empire, you didn't have them. In the Middle Ages, for example, nobles were given a landed estate, and in return they agreed to support their overlord according to custom by providing soldiers in wartime and also offering aid and counsel in peacetime. The reason that a standing army is so expensive is that you're taking a group of fit, healthy young men. These are the people who are the most productive part of your economy, who engage in agriculture or industry, they're your blacksmiths, and you get them to sit around in barracks all day, and not only that, but you have to pay them for that privilege, and you have to give them food and clothing and weapons and everything else they might need to fight a battle. Now, thanks to our mechanized and industrialized society, we have enough goods that we don't have that problem anymore, but we still have the problem that you have to keep troop morale up. During my doctoral program, my thesis advisor looked at a bandit in the Ottoman Empire named Karafezi, who had thousands of men under his command, and many of them were former members of the Ottoman military who, once they returned to home, they were in poverty, and they couldn't produce enough money to support themselves, or maybe they wanted more wealth than they had access to, but they could become bandits because there was no effective system to keep them contained. This is a universal problem, but the United States has been working actively to keep troop morale up throughout its history, but in a much more defined form since World War II, specifically through the United Service Organizations, the USO. Since 1941, the USO has been America's largest organization that serves military members and their families throughout their time in service, from the moment they join through their assignments and deployments. And the main goal is to make servicemen and servicewomen feel connected back home. So when you think of Bob Hope or Robin Williams out there entertaining troops, that's one part. But then they also send them aid packages and offer around-the-clock hospitality for traveling service members and their families. In this episode, I'm joined with Dr. J.D. Crouch, the CEO of the USO. He's a former ambassador and deputy national security advisor. And we're going to talk about the history of the USO. So we're going to talk about a history of the USO, which this year is celebrating its 80th anniversary, how the organization was formed, why it was formed, the role of the USO in supporting the role of women in the military, and also during the periods of the military before and after segregation, how the USO's programming services and entertainment have evolved from serving coffee on the front lines during World War II to providing Wi-Fi today, and anecdotes about things like when Robin Williams was caught off guard by troops during revelry, or about USO staff being made honorary members of the Green Berets in Vietnam. And we'll even look at how some of the most important things that raise troop morale are things that you would least suspect, like getting Slim Jims in combat zones. So this is a detailed look at a subject that has to do with American military history, but it's a universal issue of how do you keep troop morale high and how does that lead to stronger public order? I hope you enjoyed this discussion with J.D. Crouch. J.D., welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
Well, I am looking forward to this conversation. I say that with almost every episode, but what I enjoy is I like topics that really transcend our era and they stretch across human history. And in your professional capacity, you deal with something that human civilization has struggled with as long as we've had human civilization, and that's keeping troops happy. And that's an important thing because all of the oldest historical sources we have to do with battles and taxes. It's all battles, taxes, battles, taxes. And really, the whole reason we have taxes is to be able to raise up an army. And the reason armies are so expensive, it's not training, it's not equipment. Of course, that's important. But really, at the core, you're paying young men not just to fight, but to spend the most productive years of their life, spending a lot of time sitting around doing nothing while they're waiting to move or fight. And if you don't have a disciplined military, this can lead to a coup, this can lead to an overthrow, a civil war, or once they're demobilized and sent back home, if they don't have employment, they form bandit brigades. I studied the Ottoman Empire and they dealt with bandits who were basically military veterans who couldn't find a job but knew how to fight. So I give that introduction just to give some context of what it is the USO does, but could you give me a description before we get into the particulars of how it was formed and what it's doing now in the 21st century. What was the normal state of affairs in American history and other militaries before the USO when soldiers weren't fighting? What were they doing?
Yeah, well, you know, there were soldier support organizations. I think the British had one in the 19th century, early 20th century. There were organizations that helped to support our forces, the what was called the Allied Expeditionary Force that went to World War I. But I think the experience of that, and remember, FDR is president in 1941, and he was Assistant Secretary of the Navy during most of our participation in World War I. So right before World War II, really in February of 1941, before we get into the war through Pearl Harbor, he says, we need to change the way we're doing this. And he said, I think he believed very strongly that it ought to be a civilian-based, non-governmental organization that provided this support. And so he did a number of things. He sort of used the convening authority of the presidency to pull together six organizations that were already doing some work, you know, Traveler's Aid. You may have seen those at the airport sometimes. They're still there. They're still around. They were helping service members move around the country. The Salvation Army, YMCA, YWCA, all of these organizations were doing little pieces here and there. And so what they did is it's sort of the first roll up in nonprofit history. You know, they kind of pulled them all together and said, all right, we're going to unite these service organizations. And that's where our name comes from, the United Service Organizations. There are six stars in our flag. Those six stars represent the six original organizations that came together to form the USO in February of 1941.
Hmm. When it came together and these service organizations were brought together, were there any problems they could tell were bubbling up and they thought, okay, this is a problem and we need to address this somehow or we're going to have a bigger problem? What were some of the issues it was trying to address?
So the American military was, I don't have the numbers exactly, but prior to World War II, the army was probably 150,000 people. You know, we are now scaling up to millions of people in the armed forces. And that means that those people are going to be moving around the country. One of the concerns they had was, what happens when you put tens of thousands of young American males in some city somewhere that they've never been to before, you know? What could go wrong? So they were looking for a way to give them something, kind of a safe place to recreate, a safe place to interact. You know, in the old USO days, we had, when they scaled up, we were building something like seven centers a week or something. It was an amazing number all over the country. And these were places that sometimes were outside of military facilities where training was going on. And they would be a place for recreation, relaxation. We actually would have USO dances. You know, this is something we don't do anymore, obviously. But in those days, it was a way to put, essentially to put the males and females of the population in a place where, you know, there was safety and they were respected and all that. So we were playing a little bit of chaperone in the old days. So yes, there were problems and challenges like that the USO had to deal with. But it was really an understanding, I think, of the leadership that this creation of this 12.5 million men and women under arms is going to fundamentally change society. And we need an organization that can help to deal with that.
Right, because before this period, as you mentioned, after the demobilization from World War I, the U.S. Armed Forces is small. This has appeared in the 1920s and 1930s when an isolationist perspective is much more popular. The military was smaller by design. What were the state of affairs before? Would servicemen and servicewomen be kind of dumped into a city and then there really wouldn't be supporting infrastructure and they were left on their own? Or what was it like?
Again, I'm not saying there was nothing because, you know, the United States has a rich history of having charitable organizations, churches, other sort of organizations helping to take care of people who are in need. But there really wasn't anything that was sort of focused on those service members. Now, you look at our charter today. I mean, we are really the preeminent organization that's focused on active duty, guard and reserve and their families. after the war, there were lots of veterans organizations, people who were helping people who'd gotten out of the military. Our focus is really people who are in the military and their families. And so, and that really started out, you know, as I said, from day one, when the USO was founded in February, you know, months before we entered the war officially. But prior to that, it was a much smaller military. And there were local groups that were helping. The Navy was probably the largest of those services. And it had, there was no Air Force at that point. And they had, they obviously had support organizations in some of the major Navy towns, right? San Francisco was one of them in those days. It no longer is. The ports on the East Coast, as well as San Diego.
Because it comes into existence in World War II, could you describe some interesting historical facts from this period and what it's like when it's created? What are some of the services that develop? And yeah, what does that whole process look like?
Right. Well, the fundamental challenge, if you think about it, of military life, and this probably is true for soldiers that marched with Alexander the Great, mm-hmm. right? Okay, all the way up to today, is separation. You are separated from a normal civilian life. You're separated in the sense that it may be physical separation. You may be sent overseas or away. You're separated in the sense that you're wearing the uniform. You look different. You're separated. You're governed by different laws. In the United States, you know, the regular laws are not governed the military. It's the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And you're really separated by what you're asked to go do. Think about it. You know, there aren't that many jobs where you may be sent abroad and maybe put in a position where you've got to fight or kill, which is a really unusual situation. So that separation is what we're the antidote for, right? Connecting folks. And so it's changed over time as to how to do it, but that basic premise is still the same. If you go back to World War II, you said we had about 675,000 volunteers at the peak, Americans who volunteered for the USO. Remember the TV show, or not TV show, the movie, It's a Wonderful Life, right? You know, the main character in there, the woman who's married to Jimmy Stewart. No, she volunteers at the USO during World War II. Almost everybody volunteered at the USO or volunteered at the Red Cross. We still have over 30,000 volunteers today. And the USO across the organization. We were building an average of four of these USO clubs per day. And we totaled out at about 3,000 USO clubs across the United States and across the world. We had over 7,000 entertainers who were overseas. They gave 700 performances a day around the globe. Almost 500,000 performances between 1941 and 1947, when the demobilization was, you know, basically accelerated. And so it really was an amazing operation, having to do this and flying all over the place. We had entertainers who were killed or who were under attack as a result of this, or lost their lives doing and performing these things. And as our mission evolved, you know, we got into, you know, helping to support folks, not just with a little taste from home, which was important. A fun fact, the Coca-Cola company basically came to the USO early on. They're our largest and longest corporate partner, and said, we want to put a Coke in the hand of service members overseas. And they set up a supply network working with General Eisenhower to allow them to do that. And as the Allied armies marched across Europe, the crates of Coke came behind them. And of course, you can argue that was a good marketing strategy for them, because obviously it brought Coke along. But that Coke bottle represented a taste of home, a connection to something that was a visceral for them, that they could remember standing on the corner with their friend somewhere having a cold Coke together. And be able to put that in their hands in a battlefield in France was really something that you could not measure the value of.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. As an antidote to that, I spent a number of years living in Turkey. And when you're abroad for a long time, it's strange the things you miss. They could even be things at home that you didn't enjoy when you were at home, but simply because you can't have them, you want them abroad. So for whatever reason, there's no Dr. Pepper in most countries overseas. And I knew people who worked at the U.S. consulate, and they had access to the commissary there and the grocery store that had all these American products. They could get Dr. Pepper at cost. And there were some random Turkish grocery stores that would have them as a specialty item. It was $3 a can, some outrageous price. And it was just amazing to see Dr. Pepper. So human psychology works in weird ways. But yeah, that just to back up what you said there, it's strange the way the places that you find a morale boost. And it can be a soda that you don't drink normally at home, but when you're abroad and can't have it, it means something.
Absolutely. We have tens of thousands of these snack packs we build every year and send out. And oftentimes, you know, I'll be up on Capitol Hill and a congressman will be coming through and he'll be putting the snack pack together and he'll say, Slim Jims. Really? Is that what people want, a Slim Jims? And the answer is absolutely, because it's hard to get a Slim Jim in Afghanistan.
Right. I mean, you'd be surprised, but it's any gas station you go to, there's a Slim Jim and it just feels regular and normal.
Yep.
Just one more thing on World War II, because I think a lot of people, they think of World War II, they imagine performers going out and entertaining troops after they've been, you know, hunkered down after the Battle of the Bulge or whatever. What kind of performers went out? I think of musicians or starlets or pinup girls where the troops are wolf whistling types of things. But who are the types of people that went out in USO, just to kind of fill in the gaps are in my minds and listeners' minds as well?
Yeah, really, you almost can't put a limit on it. Artists. We had people who would go out, and this was really kind of a therapy thing in a way, but they would meet with soldiers and draw their pictures. And these pictures would be sent home. Or, you know, in some cases, and it's sad, but in some cases, if somebody had maybe lost a limb, you know, this was a way to break that news to the family. That they, you know, there was a stigma, you know, maybe associated with it back then that we wouldn't have today. But you know, that it was a way for them to, you know, kind of tell the family, I'm coming home, but, you know, I'm not going to look exactly the way I look now. There were comedians, obviously. Comedy was king, and particularly if you're in that kind of a stressful situation, to be able to get away and laugh for an hour. Obviously, everybody knows Bob Hope, but one of the ones that was absolutely hysterical was a comedian named Martha Ray. I mean, there are all kinds of documents of people writing home about Martha Ray and how funny she was and how she, and Martha Ray, along with Bob Hope, was one of those who just, you know, war after war, she hung in with, you know, Korea, Vietnam, as long as she could go. And she actually had, she was actually in a one camp overseas during World War II that came under a rocket attack or something. I mean, but she, you know, just kept going. Big bands, orchestras. There were, you know, not usually a full harmonic, but, you know, there were all kinds of events, you know, where classical music and other things was brought. So it really was a very wide array of entertainment. A lot of these people back home were trying to find a way to help. And it, you know, in many ways, it was an exciting way to help, because we could take them to places that, you know, you couldn't imagine as an American in 1942 to be able to go, right? You know, the South Pacific or wherever to entertain troops. And most of them will tell you, and they'll tell you to this day, Scott, that this is the most moving thing they've done in their careers.
One question for you. I'm really curious about logistics, because a co-host and I are doing a 30-part series on World War II in the Pacific. And we come back to logistics and supply lines and really the miracle of being able to ship weapons out to Guadalcanal, which is an absolutely microscopic island, thousands of miles away from anything. It's a miracle what they can do with supplies and food and provisions and weapons and everything else. And when I hear these things like that, I imagine, you know, performers going off to war zones, you know, a 50-something-year-old man from who's a cellist for the New York Philharmonic trying to carry his heavy cello cases. Mortars are going off behind him. Okay, it's not like that, obviously, but were there any stories of, like, you know, getting people to these places? And how do they do this? Or are there any anecdotes that stick out like that?
Well, obviously, we were reliant on the military to get people where we needed to go. I mean, it was the, it was in most of those places in the war zones, you know, you were going on, we call it Milair today, but you know, back then it was, you know, Army Air Corps, transport. And so, and depending upon the zone they were going into, you know, there were cases where an entire aircraft might go down and people would be injured. I know there was an entertainer named, I think her name was Jane Froman. She was a singer, and she was actually injured in an airplane crash in Lisbon that killed 23 other passengers on a USO tour. That was in February, I think, of 43. She actually, you know, she actually returned to Europe in 1945 after recovering from that injury and was still on crutches when she went out to perform for the troops again. Hmm. So to give you an idea of how dedicated some of our performers are, it's pretty amazing. So, yeah, the military was not thrusting people in right into a battle zone.
Right.
Because, you know, but as you know, from being a student of history, you know, war can be the forward edge of the battle area can be fluid. And if something changed, you know, the enemy has a vote. And an example of that, you go to the Vietnam War. I mean, there was actually an attempt on the life of Bob Hope and the troop he was with. Viet Cong tried to bomb the hotel that he was staying at, and I think they missed him by about 10 minutes.
Hmm.
The enemy understood that troop morale was an important thing, and anything they could do to undermine that morale would be valuable to them.
Were there cases of performers being kidnapped or captured by the enemy?
Not that I'm aware of. No kidnapper capture. And I'm not trying to say that there was wholesale, you know, lots of people died, but nobody died in Vietnam, for example. Hmm. We did have one case where in Vietnam where somebody was shot on stage, but it was actually a U.S. service member. And they don't think it was, they were the intended target. They think the intended target was somebody else. And that person, of course, did jail, you know, serious jail time for that. But mostly it was, you know, downed aircraft, things like that. Or as you know, a lot of aircraft that were downed during World War II were not downed by the enemy. They were downed just because of aircraft failures and things like that, that just, that you know, that happen in war.
Right. I mean, this is an experimental era. So for so many people to join this effort and performers to do this on technology that was, I mean, incredibly impressive, but still very rickety at the time and experimental. And with the rate of technological change, I mean, there's risk involved. Something else curious with the World War II era, this is a major expansion of the USO. And by now your organization, I would imagine after decades of work, is a very well-oiled machine. You have long experience to know what works, how to do it. But in the beginning of any enterprise that's scaling up rapidly, you have successes and you have failures. Were there any examples of things in World War II? We tried this, but we found, okay, this really doesn't work, whether as a type of entertainment, whether as a way to assist soldiers as part of that growing pains.
Sure. Well, let me, if you don't mind me just sort of digress just a quick sec, just to say that you might be surprised to know, and your viewers might be surprised, that the USO almost went out of business 3 times.
Really? Huh.
And as you might imagine, it's as a result of downturns after World War II, after Vietnam, and really after the Cold War was over. You know, we're not a government organization. We're a charity, and so when a lot of Americans felt, I think, and understandably, that, you know, well, if the war's over, there's no need for the USO. In fact, we were even decommissioned by Harry Truman in 1947. We actually continued to provide services, and then we were recommissioned in 49 as a result of Korea. So I say that only to give you the context of there have been ups and downs throughout the entire USO history. And, you know, part of my job is to make sure that never happens again. And I think we're on a good sound footing now, but we continue to need, you know, that kind of support. and awareness. You know, awareness is the important thing for us, that there are over 250,000 service members deployed overseas today, even though, you know, there are not as many hot combat zones as there were, you know, after 9/11. I'll give you one example from World War II. Somebody came up with a bright idea that, well, while we're doing this, maybe we should start charging a nickel, I think it was a nickel, for a cup of coffee and a donut. Well, this was a disaster. You know, you can imagine the public recoiled at it. The service members didn't like it. And so I think, I don't know how long it lasted, but it was more than a one-day wonder, but it was not much more than that. And since then, the USO have provided all of its services free of charge to service members. So it's an example of a kind of a blip. And you can understand why. Hey, maybe we can, you know, get more services going if we can at least get a little bit of cash flow here. But that was not the way the organization was set up. It really was set up to be something that's for those service members, it's completely free of charge.
Right. It's funny, those things like that, that they don't seem significant on a spreadsheet, but they're things that have incredible symbolism on the troop level. The fastest way to mutiny on a British ship historically was to get into the sailors' rum rations. I think that's the number one way. Of course, they like rum on a hot day, but it's just the symbolic. Or it would be like in an office taking away people's free coffee and making them pay for it, that you can't even give me coffee for all that I do for you. So those are just the little things that go a very, very long way. That's a great point.
Absolutely. Right? And remember what the USO was supposed to do. It was supposed to connect the American people to the service members that were serving them. Mm-hmm. And the way that we do that is through, you know, by handing out that cup of coffee free. It's an expression of gratitude. It's a lot more than a cup of coffee,
right?
You know, it's that expression of gratitude, and paying for it takes the blush off that.
So something that you have on your website, there are different articles that listeners can go check out after listening to this interview. You talk about the role that the USO plays at a time when the military was undergoing the incredible social change that was happening in the United States, where the military goes from segregated to desegregated, and then the role of women in the military. So what role does the USO play in those two different areas?
Right. You know, obviously, when we entered World War II, we were a segregated military. But from the very beginning, the USO was an organization that basically it welcomed anybody in uniform. It didn't matter what your color, your creed. In fact, even in our founding documents, you can see this, you go back and look at some of the board meetings and things like that of the organization. They felt that, you know, if you're wearing the uniform and you're fighting for your country, it doesn't matter. And so now, obviously, that was problematic in a way, because the military itself was not that integrated. And so we had to be creative to be able to make sure that we were serving everybody. In some cases, that meant that we had centers, for example, where for recreation that were completely integrated. But in other cases, it meant that we had to set up separate organizations or separate centers to make sure that we were serving the African American community in certain localities. This was an era where, you know, there were Jim Crow laws that didn't allow whites and blacks to be mingling in the same areas. And so obviously we had to adapt to some degree to the local legal restrictions and things like that. But what we always did was made sure that we were providing services on an equal basis, and we're helping to support black service members as well as their white counterparts. I commend you for mentioning the article. It's a really interesting article that goes into some of the detail about that and how we did that. And you know, one of the things that in reading it that I learned that was that people want to say this was, you know, focused just in the South, but there were other parts of the country where these kinds of restrictions were in place as well, even in the Northeast. And so we had to work around those. And we had a lot of courageous volunteers of all races, colors, and creeds who were willing to help us do that. So I really, I look back on those people and say that in many ways, in their own small way, they were pioneers in the civil rights movement.
Right. I mean, the episodes that I've done on civil rights, some of the most important people were entertainers because they were crossing color barriers well before other arenas of American civil life, along with baseball, too. So one of my guests, just as an aside, credits baseball with kickstarting the civil rights movement, which is a whole other different thing. Hey, everyone. Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. I want to jump ahead because you had mentioned Bob Hope. He's probably the best known celebrity connected with the USO just because he did it for so many decades. Another one, too, is Robin Williams. I think you have a story about him being caught off guard by troops during Revelry. So can you tell me about that?
Sure, sure. Well, you know, one of the things that if you're in the entertainment community and you're an entertainer, you expect to be the center of attention, right? And it's understandable. In most cases, people are paying, right, to go see you. So why wouldn't you be the center of attention? Well, Robin Williams was in, I think he was in Kuwait, and he was right in the middle of his show, telling jokes, everybody's cutting up. All of a sudden, it's evening time, and Revelry is announced, right? The end of the day, right? Everybody knows the song of, and the entire audience turns away, turns their back on him, salutes the flag until the completion of that end of, you know, the end of the day. And he tells the story that, you know, it shocked me at first. I said, you know, how could people turn their back on Robin Williams, you know? And then he realized that these are people who are doing things that are a lot bigger than me. They're serving their country, and they're, you know, this was an example of their commitment to the institutions they're in, the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marines, their commitment to the country. And they weren't going to take a break from that just to listen to Robin Williams. It touched him greatly. It affected him, and it made him want to come back. And he was a multiple tour performer. And one of the things that he did that was very similar to Bob Hope is Hope was not great just because he got people that he went. He was great because he got other people to go. And Robin Williams was the same way. We had all kinds of entertainers, comedians, you know, Jay Leno, other people who were invited, you know, to come. And I think, you know, Robin played an incredible role in doing that. He was a great loss for us.
Mm-hmm. Something I'm curious about when innovations have happened in the military. Let's take the example of public health, like Clara Barton during the Civil War or Florence Nightingale in the Crimean War. There's a night and day difference when hygienic practices are introduced of troop mortality in hospitals, and you can point to a clear before and after, or during World War II when DDT is deployed on different islands and malaria deaths are just, I mean, it is absolutely night and day difference from one to the other. Troop morale is something that's much harder to quantify statistically in the same way, but can you think of any examples of how the USO was able to affect troop morale and say, okay, had it not been for this, it would have been a much more catastrophic situation, like not spraying an island with DDT and troop morale. Not that I want to compare the USO to DDT, not the nicest analogy, but you get what I'm going for.
I understand what you're saying. Well, let me actually connect the two propositions. One of the things that health on the the improvements in health on the battlefield have allowed is that people in World War II or Korea who probably would have died from their wounds survived their wounds. And there's a fabulous chart that shows the time to triage medicine from a World War II soldier all the way up to somebody, let's say, fighting in Afghanistan or Iraq in 26 or 27. And it literally moves from days to minutes. Right. And so that's a, you know, it's a good thing, but it also imposed different requirements, you know? And so we stood up a USO, a specially dedicated USO in Landstuhl, Germany. Landstuhl, Germany is where the major medical triage was done on a lot of service members. They would obviously be stabilized, let's say in Afghanistan or Iraq, and then they would be air-vacked rapidly to Landstuhl where they had just world-class medical facilities right there. Well, who was going to help take care of them in their rehabilitation while they were there? Who was going to build their morale? Who was going to help support the families that would were flocking into Landstuhl and that area to see their wounded, you know, spouse or father or mother or whatever? And so that's what we did. And so we had a dedicated facility that we did that. And then for longer term care, we have built two facilities, one at Bethesda Naval Hospital and one at Fort Belvoir, which were designed specifically to do that, to support wounded, ill and injured, their caregivers and their families. These are world-class facilities. They're still operating today. And in fact, we've just expanded down into San Antonio where we have one of those. So that helps to build morale in many ways, but the foundational way is, you know, somebody, you know, my service member is greatly wounded. You know, are they going to be taken care of? Are the families going to be taken care of? You know, if you have a sense and you're on that battlefield, that's what happens when a buddy goes down, you know, it helps to sustain your morale. And it's not only the right thing to do, but it helps to sustain that morale, you know, for people who don't want to have to worry about their buddies that, you know, aren't beside them anymore, but that who are still living and wounded. And so it's an example of how we've innovated around that fact, because in, you know, in World War II, a lot of those people didn't make it.
Switching to, I guess, USO lore, is there anything that stands out in USO lore as the absolute best performance? And then on the flip side, I know you probably have to be a lot more delicate with this, but absolute worst. So,
well, a lot of what we do, Scott, is actually outside the performance area, right?
Right.
You know, the day-to-day stuff. I wish I could take Americans around at Christmas time to our centers, particularly the ones overseas, but even the ones here stateside on military bases. I'll tell you a personal story, if you don't mind. I walked into USO at Bagram Air Force Base on Christmas Eve 4 or 5 years ago. And this is called the Pat Tillman Center. It was named after the football player, remember, Pat Tillman, who volunteered for his country and then tragically killed, I think, in a friendly fire incident. So I'm in there, I walk in, and there are four service members, three guys and a woman. They have their M4s slung over their backs. They're sitting at a small table, and you know what they're doing? They're making a gingerbread house. And they have these grins on their faces. And I actually have it captured in a photograph. And you know, I, at the time I thought, why are they doing this? And it realized they probably wouldn't even do this at home. They probably wouldn't make a gingerbread house at home. But for that moment, for that hour, they were sitting there and doing that. They were transformed. They had been teleported like Star Trek, you know, back to the kitchen table in their home, around which maybe their brothers and sisters or children were doing something similar. And it made all the difference in the world for them, right? So I know that's not the, you know, the big flashy thing, but it's the kind of thing that happens 100,000 times a year on a very small basis, you know, but that it really lifts people's spirits. I'm trying to answer the other half of your question. I'm trying to come up with the worst, the worst thing. I mean, let me tell you, one of the funny things with entertainers is, and we have to be very careful about this, because
right.
Some entertainers need, how shall I put it? They need a lot of gear when they go overseas. Our typical performances overseas are more like the stuff when you hear about, you know, Eric Clapton unplugged, right? Or so-and-so unplugged. And if you don't do unplugged, it's not going to work very well. But we had a great, I think it may have been Kelly Pickler, I can't remember. She was in an aircraft hangar in Afghanistan somewhere. And, you know, I don't know whether it was a rocket attack or something, all of a sudden, boom, all power on the base goes down, right? And literally, she's standing there in the middle of darkness. I mean, nobody can even see 5 inches in front of their face. In her own way, she just drove on. She just kept singing, right? Finally, the lights came back up, right? They got it fixed, you know? But stuff like that would happen all the time because it wasn't the perfect show. And I think the entertainers that really like going, they thrived on that. You know, they thrived on the fact that it was going to be a challenge to do their show. It was going to be a challenge to be perfect. You know, they're all perfectionists and they want to be great, but they knew it was going to a different operating environment, and they were going to have to, as we say in the military, adapt and overcome, right?
Right. It's a whole different mentality, like with Van Halen famously putting the clause that they can only have brown M&Ms in the green room because they want to make sure that all the other tech specs are being followed just as thoroughly. So that's great for putting on a performance if you're at, I don't know, the Sprint Center in whatever major metropolitan area. In Afghanistan, not so good. So, right.
Very. Totally not, yeah. In fact, sometimes the green room was a pup tent.
Right. If you had one. So you got to take what you get. Getting back to what we started with in this discussion about how, I mean, what you're dealing with, it's specific to the American military in the 21st century, but it's also a timeless issue, just like zooming out very far away from individuals and looking at this as a broad social thing, that a military that's happy, it's good for society. Thankfully, our military is disciplined enough that they wouldn't run out and form bandit brigades like you would see in empires 400 years ago. But just broadly for social stability, it's good to have a military that is as happy as it can be in very trying situations. So do you see, what are unique things for the USO as it goes into the 21st century? And then what are also timeless issues that it has dealt with in decades past and will continue to deal with in decades to come?
Right. Your observation is spot on. And you can get overly comfortable in a democracy like ours, thinking that, oh, everything will be fine. Our military is very disciplined about being constitutionally under the direction of the president and civil authorities and all that. I mean, it's drummed into them from day one, and they're very good about it. But you don't want a military that has poor morale, and you don't want a military that's disconnected from the American people. I think one of the biggest challenges that's different today is, and it affects the USO, but it also affects the military generally, is the all-volunteer force. A very small percentage of the United States citizens actually serve, you know, less than 1% serve at any one time. And if you look at just the number of, let's say, as a barometer, the number of people in Congress who served in the military, it's dropped year after year after year, and probably will continue to drop. Not because congressmen are unpatriotic, just because there's fewer people in the military broadly because of that all-volunteer force. And anyway, I think the all-volunteer force is great, but it has that social consequence. And what that means is that it's not that Americans don't like their military. They actually hold them in very high regard. It's not that they don't have sympathy, but they don't have what we call empathy. They don't really understand what it's like, because not only have they not served, they don't even have anybody in their immediate family has served. So that is a societal issue that we have to deal with. We have to continue, if we're going to have, we say at the USO, a strong America is a force for good in the world, and a strong military is necessary to have a strong America. Well, to do that, we have to keep the American people connected to that military in some way. And we play a part in that through our volunteers. We have over 1 million active donors, through companies we interact with, all the way from tech companies, you know, that might have a more liberal perspective to more conservative companies. It doesn't matter. They all support the USO, and they all support service members through the USO. So that's a challenge that we're going to have to continue as a society to work on, because I think, you know, until that day when the lion lies down with the lamb, we're going to have a military, and we have to be able to attract young people who are willing to serve in that capacity.
All right. Well, thank you for sharing all this with us. And for people who want to learn more about the USO, where is the best place to find it online?
Go to our website, uso.org. USO.org. and you can see how you can get involved. And I would just say, if you're interested in the entertainment stuff, go see what we're doing at uso.org/MVP, Military Virtual Programming. And I think you'll see, give you a good taste of some of the stuff that we're doing in the entertainment space.
All right. Sounds great. Well, JD, thank you for joining us and sharing all this with us.
Scott, thank you very much.
Okay, well, that wraps things up for today's episode. Thank you so much for sticking with me to the end. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our Spymasters include Bill Ivey, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tom from Ohio, Ryan Gillen, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael from New York, Carl from Norway, Josh Reddick, Jennifer French Lee, Jay Carrington, McCrays, Salvador Sanchez, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraser. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.